evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, South Korea's president criticizes the captain and crew of the ship that sank with 476 people on board. Ukraine looms over U.S. President Barack Obama's trip to Asia, and the Boston Red Sox honors the family of the Chinese student killed in last year's Boston Marathon bombings. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. South Korean President Park Geun-hye today lashed out at the captain and crew of the ill-fated ferry that sank off the South Korean coast last week for what she called their incomprehensible behavior.
선장과 일부 승무원들의 행위는 상식적으로 도저히
President Park said their conduct is unfathomable from the viewpoint of common sense and said it was like an act of murder that cannot and should not be tolerated. While telling the passengers on the Sewol to stay where they were, the crew left the passengers and escaped first. This, she says, is legally and ethically unimaginable. The captain, the third mate, and one other crew member were arrested Saturday on charges of deserting their passengers as the ferry was sinking. Prosecutors say four more crew members have been detained on allegations of failing to protect passengers. More than 60 of the 476 people on board are known to have died, with about 240 still listed as missing. Rescuers saved 174 people as the vessel sank. Most of the victims were high school students. Marine traffic control transcripts released Sunday showed that the crew was hesitant to order passengers to abandon ship. The captain has said he did not order an immediate evacuation because he feared the passengers would be in danger from the strong currents in the cold water, which is about 10 degrees Celsius. Tracking data shows the ship took a sharp turn while navigating a group of small islands off South Korea's southwestern coast. Authorities have not established the cause of the disaster, but some survivors report hearing a loud impact before the vessel tilted and began sinking. South Korean prosecutors say the ferry was being steered by a 26-year-old third mate who was navigating the area for the first time. Donald Rothwell, a professor of international law at Australian National University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty it appears there was confusion in the crucial early hours of the disaster between the ferry crew and the South Korean rescue authorities.
A country like Korea would have fairly sophisticated search and rescue maritime capability and response, but the evidence at the moment suggests that there may well have been some failings in that system. And the way in which the maritime safety authorities responded to the mayday request from the crew of the ferry.
When that cruise liner grounded and tilted over off the Italian coast, we had spoken about that issue. Had anything been learned to have prevented this tragedy?
I think there is clear parallels at one level with the Costa Concordia event and the Sewol event. But perhaps of greater relevance is the fact that throughout East Asia and Southeast Asia over the last decade, we've seen a number of maritime disasters involving ferries. And most importantly, in 2013, the International Maritime Organization convened a regional conference in October looking precisely at this issue and reached agreement on a set of mechanisms for countries in East and Southeast Asia to try to respond to this particular issue. And that very much focused on coordination with respect to maritime safety authorities and related maritime authorities in terms of the safety and security of domestic ferries. What I think will now come under the spotlight is how Korea sought to respond to some of those initiatives from October 2013.
Do you think these regional efforts will be accelerated as a result of this tragedy?
Most definitely, because we've seen a significant track record of maritime disasters involving very significant loss of life in ferries throughout East Asia and Southeast Asia. Some of these have been purely domestic events, and the Sewol ferry incident is one occurring entirely within Korean waters. Last year, we had a major ferry disaster also in Hong Kong Harbour. So I expect that this will continue to show the need for reform by local maritime authorities, with a very particular focus on these ferry disasters.
Did you see shortcomings in the government's response to this tragedy, which obviously had to be rapid to try to secure as many lives as possible?
Well, I think the communications that have been revealed between the ferry and the search and rescue authorities is certainly highlighting some possible shortcomings. Having said that, Korea does have a very long coastline, and it's not possible, of course, for search and rescue authorities to have infrastructure available to respond in an instant to any particular incident such as this on any particular occasion. So there needs to be some realisation that capacity needs to be activated and responded to. Having said all of that, given the amount of time that it took for this ferry to completely list on its side, it seems as if there may well have been time to appropriately respond to this incident.
Donald Rothwell of the Australian National University. Stephen Norper, vice president of the New York-based Korea Society, calls the seawall sinking a truly national tragedy.
There's a sense of not only loss, but a sense of national embarrassment, questions about how this has been handled and why the tragedy took place in the first place.
Has something like this happened in South Korea before?
It's happened in South Korea quite a while ago, in the early 1990s and then again in 1970. And I think that's something that has given South Koreans pause, because they have done so miraculously in terms of their modernization and development. It's a very impressive place in terms of technology and capabilities, industry leaders with companies like Samsung and Hyundai and LG. And I think this has given some people real pause. They're very deeply concerned about how the accident took place. Korea is among the largest shipbuilding nations in the world, and they have a long maritime tradition. But this was a very treacherous waterway, and certainly the individual at the control shouldn't have been at the time.
There's a lot of discussion about marine traffic control transcripts that were released Sunday showing the crew hesitant to order passengers to abandon ship. That's amazing.
It is amazing. The captain claimed that that call was basically designed to prevent people from drifting away at sea, but I'm certain that will be, you know, evaluated and reevaluated in terms of the appropriateness of it. One of the interesting observations is that in a society that's largely Confucian-based, where one listens to authority, where education is so highly valued and the orders from authority, from teachers and others, is widely respected, that may well have kept students in the cabins if directed so, and that would be tragic in terms of what was a larger loss of life than perhaps need be.
Do South Korean students take trips like this on ferries?
It's very common to take school trips, I mean, just as it is in the West, but certainly the way that Koreans identify with their classes, that's very important, especially as they head toward university, a certain esprit de corps, and so it's just tragic that this affected one high school, you know, so disproportionately, and to lose so many young people age 16 and 17 is a terrible catastrophe, and there's really been a national outpouring in Korea of sympathy and cancellation of sports and other celebrations and festivities and observations of entertainment nature, just to show sympathy for the loss of life. And everyone feels so very, very deeply for those parents who have lost their children.
Stephen Norper of the Korea Society. A memorial service for the many of the victims is planned Wednesday in Ansan, South Korea, home to many of the students on board. The South Korean news agency Yonhap reports 325 students from Danwon High School in Ansan were on board the ferry. Meanwhile, rescue officials have mobilized more than 200 boats, including 90 Coast Guard vessels and 32 Navy ships, 34 aircraft, and hundreds of personnel, including divers using remotely operated vehicles, to conduct search operations inside the ferry. This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, we learn about the life of a Vietnamese refugee following the Vietnam War. U.S. President Barack Obama's trip to Asia this week comes as concerns about Beijing's territorial ambitions are growing in the region. Those concerns have been compounded by Russia's recent actions in Ukraine and the possibility that Chinese strategists might be looking to Crimea as a model for its territorial disputes with its neighbors. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
Ukraine may seem far removed from events unfolding in one of the world's most dynamic regions, a key driver of the global economy. But it is clearly on the minds of U.S. officials. Speaking at a security conference in Indonesia last month, Admiral Harry Harris, commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, talked about the need for all countries in the region to work to avoid a Crimea-type situation in the Pacific. Earlier in April, Daniel Russell, Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, told U.S. lawmakers that sanctions the U.S. and European Union placed on Russia should have a chilling effect on anyone in China who might be thinking about using Crimea as a model. He also said that sanctions put pressure on China to show it is committed to peaceful resolution of its disputes in the region. Over the past 2 years, China has put increasing pressure on Japan in a dispute over islands in the East China Sea. It has sent Coast Guard patrols and drones to assert its claims. Late last year, it unilaterally announced an air defense identification zone, which includes the islands. Jean-Pierre Cabestan, a political scientist at Hong Kong Baptist University, says there is clearly a temptation for Beijing to try and alter the status quo. But he adds, there are big differences between China's disputes in Asia and what has happened on the Crimean Peninsula.
For one thing, Japan is a U.S. ally. There is a security treaty between Japan and the U.S., which compelled the U.S. to intervene. And China knows it, I think even more so today, because the U.S. Obama administration has sent a number of very clear signals to China that the U.S. would be involved in any armed conflict around the Senkaku.
Still, Cabestan says it is hard to predict whether China may ultimately take inspiration from what Russia did in Crimea. When it comes to the dispute over uninhabited islands in the East China Sea, known as the Senkakus in Japan and Diaoyu Islands in China, Beijing's options are limited. Japan controls the islands, and attempts to even land on them in the past by Chinese activists have not lasted long. Xie Tao, a political scientist at Beijing Foreign Studies University, says if the Chinese government was to support some sort of effort by fishermen or others to land on the islands for a period of time and then proclaim sovereignty, that could backfire.
Everybody knows that it cannot sustain any long-term, you know, human settlement. And if you do that, that's obviously a trap set by the Chinese government. And that will only incur, you know, international condemnation and international criticism.
The United States says it does not take sides in the disputes, be it in the East or South China Sea. But Washington's efforts to rebalance its position in the region by shoring up diplomatic, economic, political, and security ties has raised concerns in China. Some here see that effort, or pivot to Asia as it is called, as an attempt to contain Beijing's rise. They also argue that Washington's actions are emboldening its allies in the region to raise tensions. Just days before President Obama embarks on his trip, Japan announced a decision to expand its military footprint, deploying troops and radar to an island near the disputed area in the East China Sea. China says it is seeking to peacefully resolve its disputes in the region and has accused Japan of hyping regional threats to justify its military expansion. Japan will be the first stop on President Obama's four-nation tour of the region, which includes visits to South Korea and to other Southeast Asian nations that have territorial disputes with China in the South China Sea, the Philippines, and Malaysia. Last year, a government shutdown in Washington forced President Obama to cancel his attendance at the APEC Leaders' Summit. Cabestan says this year's trip is part of an effort to pick up from where he left off.
President Obama wants to repair his non-participation to the APEC summit in Indonesia in the fall last year. That created some frustration and unease in Asia, in particular among U.S. allies, because it gave the occasion for China to sort of run the show in place of Obama.
Political scientist Xie Tao says Beijing will be watching closely to see what Mr. Obama does to reassure his allies in the region, whether he plays the role of peacemaker by promoting regional stability or plays up negative perceptions about China.
I would hope that he would do something to assuage China's suspicion for he's not really here to contain China.
One key test of that, Xie adds, will be Mr. Obama's stop in Malaysia. The stop in Malaysia will be the first for a U.S. president in nearly five decades and comes at a time when relations between Kuala Lumpur and Beijing are under tremendous strain following the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. Bill Eyde, VOA News, Beijing.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. An immigrant story involves far more than just relocation. Transition to a new life in a new place can sometimes involve a journey filled with danger and hope. VOA's Ray Kugel tells us about a short film that describes in a most unusual way what happened to a Vietnamese refugee in the aftermath of the Vietnam War.
Mitchell Pham is one of the lucky ones. He survived a danger-filled experience escaping from Vietnam with his family for political and economic reasons after the war ended in April 1975. His story is explained in a captivating brief film called Eat Your Cake, I'm a Vietnamese Refugee. Pham's tale is one of spending 6 months under harsh conditions in a prison, escaping by boat in stormy seas with dwindling supplies, and finding brief refuge on an oil rig before being sent to the first of four refugee camps for 18 months. It was there, at the age of 12, that Pham found safety with barracks to sleep in, a library, and learning how to read and write English. His language skills helped send him to relocation and a new life in New Zealand. Eat Your Cake, I'm a Vietnamese Refugee is a pretty amazing thing to watch. This is no ordinary documentary. Director-writer Sally Tran uses colorful traditional Vietnamese paper folding, stop-frame animation, and inventive soundtrack and actual interviews with Pham to make this a unique visual experience.
Were there a lot of young people like you?
Well, there were a lot of people there of all ages and backgrounds, and they all came with their own stories. And some of them were real horror stories, too. I remember meeting some people who'd been there for 10 or more years already, and they weren't going anywhere because they couldn't go back to Vietnam. Other countries didn't accept them, so they couldn't migrate anywhere. Some of them even died in the camps. The biggest fear that they had were to actually die there in a place of limbo. Their families wouldn't know what happened to them at all.
Tran is a second-generation Vietnamese, New Zealand-born. Now based in New York and Ho Chi Minh City, I asked Tran how she came up with the idea to make the film and about the very creative techniques used for it.
I met Mitchell through sort of Asian networking in Auckland in New Zealand, and there's a very few Vietnamese people that live in Auckland, so it's always great to meet another Vietnamese person. And he told his story, and I thought it was really remarkable, and he's a very successful businessman in New Zealand. So I thought it would be great to kind of tell his full story, just sort of from his journey into New Zealand and what he's achieved.
What was Pham's reaction to having a film made about him?
He was absolutely thrilled about it. It was great. You know, it'd be interesting. And he really liked the idea that it was going to be made, you know, half animation and half documentary.
How typical are Pham's experiences as part of New Zealand's refugee community?
I think it is common. I think what's not so common is probably Mitchell's success story that comes afterwards that I had planned to tell, but decided the story was too long. It was too long for a short film and too short for a feature film.
Is New Zealand receptive towards Vietnamese refugees now? And if so, how are they doing?
The Vietnamese community in New Zealand is very, very small. And most of the Vietnamese refugees live in South Auckland. And I think people are very open with Vietnamese refugees. I think they do well and they integrated well.
What made you decide to make a film with paper craft and stop frame animation?
I love paper. Paper is one of my loves. And stop frame animation is also one of my loves in terms of telling stories through the style of craft. And I thought it was just appropriate for this story being about a Vietnamese refugee, and the whole sort of animation sequence within that film is all, you know, traditional Vietnamese paper folding. So it's called 3D origami. And I thought it would be more appealing for a young audience to watch a film like that.
How difficult was it to do the paper craft, and how many people were involved in that aspect of the film?
It was a very time-consuming process. The paper folding itself is simple. It's just a triangle. And we made about a good 5,000 of those triangles in different colour and different sizes. We had a team of about 20 that came every Sunday to my workshops, and I would just sit there watching movies, listening to music, folding these paper triangles. And we had a paper origami expert, and she would be making the structures as these little paper triangles are folded. And then another couple of months to actually catch the animation.
Is the film aimed at a particular audience in New Zealand or Vietnam or anywhere else?
Mainly my pitch was for New Zealand, young 8 to 15. And I wanted to show it through schools in New Zealand. And I think that it's also a very international story.
What's the significance of the title, Eat Your Cake?
Once I met Mitchell, I thought it was sort of appropriate to name the film that, where I thought that he was doing exactly that. He was finding himself and realizing that he was also able to, as a refugee, to have his cake and eat it too, because being such a successful businessman in New Zealand.
Fahms found success as a co-founder of a tech company in New Zealand. Trans Eat Your Cake, I'm a Vietnamese Refugee, is more than just the profile of a man who overcame tremendous odds and peril to survive and prosper in New Zealand. This is just a darn good little movie. I'm Ray Kugel.
Quite a good recommendation there from Ray. Well, for more information, go to www.nzonscreen.com/eatyourcake. Well, last night in Boston, the Red Sox baseball team held an emotional pregame tribute to the victims of last year's Boston Marathon bombings. The family of Liu Lingzi, a Boston University graduate student from China who was one of the three people killed in the blast, participated in the ceremony. The Liu family members made their first visit to Fenway Park, the home of the Boston Red Sox, and ended the ceremony with the traditional play ball chant before the Red Sox began their game against the Baltimore Orioles. And the Red Sox defeated the Orioles 6-5. Meanwhile, today, an expanded field of runners is set to compete in this year's Boston Marathon. Several thousand runners who started last year's race but were not able to finish have also been invited back. And please make sure you look at our website, voanews.com. We will have all the latest about this year's Boston Marathon. And best of luck to all the participants and the city, which really deserves it. Thanks very much for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Sarah Williams. Please stay tuned for International Edition with Dave DeForest, coming up next.